Support for the show comes from Atlassian. Having trouble getting things done at work? You're not alone. Maybe in order to unlock amazing outcomes, it's time to stop looking up and down for answers and instead start looking across. What do we mean by that? The companies with the fastest speed to market tend to be the ones that look across the organization rather than up and down the hierarchy. Stay tuned to hear how Atlassian software like Confluence, Jira, and Loom can help maximize effective teamwork in your organization. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Support for Pivot comes from ServiceNow. By now, you've probably heard about AI. You might even be sick of hearing about it. But despite all the hype, it's not always clear how AI can help your business. ServiceNow has some ideas. With their intelligent platform, they can put AI to work across your company, improving customer experiences, helping non-coders code, accelerating your IT team's productivity, and resolving HR cases faster. So work can actually work better for everyone. So stop the hype and start putting AI to work. Go to servicenow.com/genAI to see why the world works with ServiceNow.
Hi, everyone. This is Pivot from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Kara Swisher. Scott Galloway is in line at the bank trying to get his money out. Now he can. Today, I'm joined by pop culture expert, Texan, and host of Intuit, Sam Sanders. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, Kara. It's so good to be here joining you from Austin, just an hour and a half north of my hometown of San Antonio.
Wow. We're both in Austin. We're at South by Southwest. I do a bunch of interviews. You're doing a bunch of things. We had a nice Vox Media dinner last night. What have you been doing here?
So on Friday night, I got to moderate the panel for the premiere of Swarm, this new Amazon Prime video show, the brainchild of Donald Glover. It's all about a pop star who feels a lot like Beyonce and a super fan of hers starts to kill people for this pop star. And it is probably the first time I've ever seen a Black woman serial killer on screen. Wow. It is really good. So that was Friday night.
So wait, so that's like the beehive getting murderous, right?
Exactly. That's why it's called Swarm. Yeah.
Right, got
it. Apparently Beyonce's seen it. I have an interview with the showrunner that runs tomorrow in my podcast feed. It's a good show. It's a really good show.
A murderous fan. Because why? Tell me why.
It makes you question a lot of the ways that we are all fans of people that we love.
Yes.
It makes you question internet and social media culture. It's one of those shows that leaves you with more questions than answers. And I love those. It was really good.
Right. Seems dark. Murderous fans. Wow.
And then on Tuesday, I'm interviewing Julio Torres, a former SNL writer, has a few comedy specials and a former show on, I think, HBO called Los Espookies. He has a new kind of comedic movie about immigration.
Always a funny topic, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's him and Tilda Swinton, and she's wonderfully crazy in this movie.
Yeah,
and the whole thing is just whimsical and delightful. So that's my week. What about you?
That's great. I had to interview Kevin Systrom, he's the founder of Instagram, co-founder. And then he has a new company called Artifact. He's trying to change the way people read news and get good quality news. And that was great. It was on the main stage. And then I did a little thing with Jose Andres, who was quite
I was there for that.
You asked a good question. He was really, really great. I don't think he gave you an answer, but nonetheless, it was good. And he's obviously a famous chef, World Central Kitchen. This morning, I had a thing with Slack where I interviewed Lawrence Wright, who is a great writer, and he wrote a big piece about Austin and the changing Austin. Essentially, Austin is inheriting all the jackasses who left San Francisco. And I was like, good luck. You know, the ones who complained about San Francisco and wouldn't stop complaining. A lot of them are here or in Miami. And so we talked about that and the changing nature of this city, which is sort of a well of liberalism in Texas, which is quite conservative, and also how that changes with all these libertarians, and especially someone like Elon Musk moving in. And so,
who wants to build his own town, right?
He wants to build his own town, but there's lots of people. Joe Lonsdale, a whole bunch of people have moved here, along with more Hollywood celebrities, etc. And it was good. He's been here since 1980, so he's an immigrant to the city too.
Yeah.
But loves it. He's from Texas, also, like you are. Yeah. And so it was good discussion about the changing nature. And as we were talking, we were surrounded by all these giant buildings. And Austin has changed so much. And this idea of keep Austin weird is that sort of a quaint.
That's over.
It's over. And these people that are coming in are not, they're weird in a bad way, in a dark way. And so we'll see.
I have been coming to Austin since I was a kid in San Antonio, mm-hmm. and it actually used to be weird. It actually used to be edgy, yeah. and it's kind of gone the same way as Portland, Oregon. Yep. It's almost yep. sister city. It got too expensive, and now yeah. you walk down South Congress, where it mm-hmm. used to be the live music capital of the world.
Yep.
You know, there's a Soho House and these mm-hmm. fancy stores I usually only see in Los Angeles. It feels like Los Angeles.
Yes, it does in a lot of ways. And, yeah. you know, I have to say, San Francisco, I'm going back in a week. It's gotten better. It's been cleared out. It's like the rains have come. We've washed out the assholes uh-huh. and it's back to being just a lovely place to
oh,
live.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we have problems. But one of the things that drives me nuts is how these people leave and they can't stop talking about San Francisco and the California. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm like, well, you're welcome for the internet, all those fruits and vegetables, and we will keep innovating and you can.
Exactly.
Good luck. Good luck
oh, yeah.
here.
Yeah.
Good luck wherever you go.
Yeah.
So.
My only fear with the folks coming to Austin, mm-hmm. It's already getting too expensive for folks. And it seems
expensive.
Like some of the tech bros that have come out here are going to start to trickle down to San Antonio.
Yeah.
Don't do
they
it.
Are. Yeah,
leave my
yeah.
city alone.
Oh,
leave San
no,
Antonio
they can't.
Out of this.
They want to take over. They're like a mold, my friend. You'll
yes.
see. You'll see. And then they'll complain about the homelessness or you're too nice mm-hmm. to poor people. And then mm-hmm. we'll go on from there. They could care less
yeah.
about anybody but themselves. Anyway, good luck, Texas. Enjoy. We're happy. When they started complaining, there's two things that happened when they left. Many for Miami, many for Texas. And Texas has had a very significant tech scene for a long time. Not a huge one, but
yeah.
very important with Dell.
People forget Dell came from Texas, yeah.
Apple had a big facility, a lot of stuff. And it started off as a place where we were going to win in the semiconductor wars in the 80s. So it's had a long history. And it's never, you know, rivaled Silicon Valley. It still doesn't. But nonetheless, the rocketry has been here. And Elon's it's just the latest, but it's always NASA's been here and everything. And one of the things that was interesting is when they leave, they always talk endlessly about San Francisco. And it always reminds me of like a girlfriend, someone who broke up with you and you can't stop talking how much you hate her. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then,
oh, yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, good luck, goodbye, see you. Don't let the door hit you on the way
yeah.
out. That's
well,
my
and
feeling.
This is what always bothers me about those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
They have the means to move anywhere, but
Check.
They're awful everywhere.
Yes, they
never
are.
Find
and
a
also,
place where they'll be happy and nice.
No, exactly.
Happen.
And also, they're here for taxes. They don't have them. They
yeah.
don't like taxes, and
yeah.
they don't like poor people and having to pay for poor people or homeless people. And so
mm-hmm.
they blame it on wokeism and this and that. And they'll do the same thing here. They're
yeah.
they're like locusts. And you're welcome for your billionaire fortunes. You should thank California. And whatever.
Yeah.
Good luck. I hope they build things. And just remember, Alex Jones is a homegrown native here. So you can build. You can make your own assholes, manufacturer.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I love Austin. I do love Austin, and I have a great time.
Have you
here,
had some good barbecue?
Yes, I have a little
Where'd
bit.
Where'd you go?
Salt Lake. I can't eat meat as much as I used to. I don't eat as much, but
then why
I love
are you
it.
Here, Kara?
I love barbecue, but I'm getting old, Sam.
I got the big beef rib.
Where'd you
go? At Terry Black's Barbecue.
Oh, nice. Anyway, today we'll talk about laundry, taxes, and the Oscars. That's why you're here. Near
yeah.
sweep by everything, everywhere, all at once. And also the worst case scenarios playing out in user online privacy. We'll get to that. And we'll take a listener question about podcasting. Sam, you have to answer that.
Okay.
Let's talk briefly about the latest with Silicon Valley Bank. President Biden addressed the nation early on Monday. He said that executives at failed banks would be fired, deservedly. His comments came after the government shut down another bank over the weekend, Signature Bank. The government has said that depositors in both banks will be made whole even above the $250,000 insurance mark of the FDIC. Mark, investors on the other hand, will not be bailed out, as they should not. Here's President Biden.
Investors in the banks will not be protected. They knowingly took a risk, and when the risk didn't pay off, investors lose their money. That's how capitalism works.
I think he's correct. Investors should not be protected. They took a risk. That's how capitalism works. A very good way of saying it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk more when Scott returns on Friday. But one of the things that I would like people to remember for a disclosure is Vox Media banks with SVB. Jim Bankoff had a sigh of relief last night when that was announced. This is not a bailout, by the way. This is not a bailout. They are going to take control of the treasuries and the assets. The reason they had trouble is they were doing a fire sale on treasuries. And that's why they were losing the money. The government's just going to hold on to these assets and own them, presumably. They will also own the loans, so they possibly could make money on this. This is not a bailout of rich people. The rich people who are the investors are getting hosed, as they should be. But just try to keep that in mind. And there's been a little bit of ugliness about, let's not say rich tech people. These are small businesses, lots of employees. There's no good, especially when there's no cost to the federal government here. It's the right thing to do. It's an elegant, easy solution. And it's the government at work. And what really drove me crazy, I had a lot of difficulty over the weekend because a lot of the tech bros were screaming in all caps about this and that.
Hate they were government. Mad about this?
No, they were mad about the government not stepping in. Of course the government was going to step in. They are just so dumb.
Yeah.
And they just scream, and now they're taking credit for screaming. And what they did is cause panic and fear and anger and everything else, and they did no good, and you didn't have an impact, boys. And let me just say, on Pivot, we had an emergency one. Everything we said was going to happen happened because we're calm and we don't have to scream just because I get stuck a little bit.
This is what I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
I've been reading up on this. I don't know this world too well, but I have been getting some really interesting emails from First Republic Bank the last few days.
Yes,
I just signed
haven't.
A mortgage with them.
Oh, that's your mortgage will be fine.
Don't worry. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I was reading about, or a few things I was reading about with this bank failure, the thing that this bank was going through happens to a lot of banks, and the way that they were going to address it is the way a lot of banks address it, but they didn't communicate effectively to this type of crowd. I keep reading that...
Yeah, this crowd sold fast. They're very online. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. This is a different type of bank customer. Mm-hmm. If my bank all of a sudden had to start selling shares or buying things or this or that, I wouldn't know and I wouldn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be fine, right? But it seems as if all these customers at Silicon Valley Bank didn't just know the things that were happening. They were gossiping and talking with everyone else, and they all kind of ginned up some fear.
Some of them might have done a run on purpose. Some of them might have done it. They're going to look into that. They're going to investigate that. If this was a classic run on a bank, spurred by online mania and spurred by all caps screamers about things. And you know what? It was solvent on Wednesday. This didn't have to go down this way.
So if these tech bros and these startup folks and these Silicon Valley types were less online, could this have been avoided?
Yes. Well,
okay.
Sort of. I think what happened was, you know, these startups need this money, and so their VCs wrote them. Some of them said, by the way, some VCs acted with great responsibility, 100%.
Okay.
And, you know, this was a good bank for Silicon Valley people. It catered to their needs, right? They have very specialized needs and very helpful. A lot of people banked with them. Every startup I know banked with them. I'm very familiar with them. What they did is they made a bad decision to buy treasuries and hold them as the interest rates were going up. They should have been smarter about that.
Yeah.
They were fired because they made a bad decision. This is not fraud. The assets aren't gone. It's not FTX. And one of the things that's infuriating is this entry into the conversation. I don't think it really does have an impact with regulators in any way. They didn't pressure anybody. Then they take a lap. That drives me crazy that they did something. They did nothing. They created a panic is what they did. And that's the problem here. And one of the things that regulators just handle it the way they do with banking crises very well, I would say. I think they did the last couple. Both Republicans and Democrats did a good job on the last couple of financial scares. It's really scary and difficult. And one of the things that's important to remember is that this is not fraud. And again, it's just incompetence, I guess, in terms of not anticipating the rise in interest rates and being stuck in 3-year treasury bonds. The government can hold them, and then they'll get the money back, and that'll be that. And so, good outcome.
Is this going to have any kind of chilling effect on Silicon Valley and startup land in general?
It's already happening with the layoffs. I think it'll give an opportunity to do more layoffs and get rid of startups that aren't working. That VCs will use it because they're rapacious fucks, and so that's what they'll do. They'll clear their thing out and blame it on something else. But it's a contraction happening in Silicon Valley, and it's natural. It's just the way things are. Kevin Systrom had all his startup money in Silicon Valley Bank. And he was like, all of it. He goes, what's 1% less than 100%? He had 99% of his money, and he didn't know what he was going to do Monday. He's also a billionaire, so yes, he's fine. He has 5 people, so it was a little easier, right? And he has money, but it was a little scary for everyone. It's touch and go if you can't have access to your capital. Yeah. You know?
I will say, from the outside looking in, because I don't cover Silicon Valley, from the outside looking in, It feels like the people in charge did what they needed to do.
That is
Yellen
correct.
And Biden took care of it. So yep. Thanks, guys.
Yes, they do. Thanks a lot. And yeah. you tech bros, you did nothing and you deserve no credit. Anyway, I whacked them all night long. I was like, yeah. Stop it. Stop yeah. screaming. Stop yeah. pissing in your pants. Stop that pissing part. Your pants, you bunch of wimps, and mm-hmm. shut up and stuff. And also, they moved from being COVID experts to banking experts. That's my favorite thing. One thing that's interesting, this is from Britain, and you may have some familiarity. Sports broadcaster Gary Lineker was back in the host chair after the BBC suspended him for tweeting criticism of the government's migration policies. He called the government policy to stop people from crossing the English Channel immeasurably cruel. The BBC suspended him for comment. He's a sports commentator. This is a weird one. Many of his colleagues walked out on solidarity, calling it disruption in BBC sports coverage. He's a very popular soccer football show. I guess soccer, though. Mm-hmm. On Monday, the two parties announced a deal had been reached for Lineker to return to air. The director general of the BBC apologized and said the network would launch a review of its social media guidelines. You work for NPR, right? And this is the same kind of thing. How do you navigate? Like, if you talk about stuff like that, you're a manager, you cover culture. So
yeah, I used to cover politics. And it was a lot stricter there.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times the rules need to be beat specific. There are things I couldn't say when I was covering the election for president, right? Mm-hmm. And I got that. But now I cover pop culture for a living. I should be able to say what I want.
Yeah.
Before I left NPR, I was on a committee that had set out to rewrite their social media ethics guidelines. The work was never finished. Literally nothing ever happened. You cannot regulate this because what you're asking these companies to do is impossible. These are people's personal Twitter accounts, personal social media accounts. And the company is basically saying, either the BBC or whoever, they're saying we should have the right not just to monitor what you post on these things, but to tell you how you post. And you need to do it from your personal account to amplify our work. And we're not going to pay you for your tweets, but we're going to tell you how to tweet. Mm-hmm. It's an impossible ask.
Yeah, because this has become sort of the way people vent, navigate, have their thoughts and everything else. And so it's weird. And some people do cross the line if you're covering politics and say, I hate Trump. Like, it's a problem. Like, that I can think they can intervene in, even though I've always thought this idea of having no opinion is ridiculous.
Well, the idea of having no opinion as a journalist, this idea of the objective journalist, it only serves... Right. Privileged, wealthy, educated, white, straight men. Because that is a default for objectivity.
Right.
And so when people say you have to perform, they're basically saying, be less black, be less woman, be less gay, be less of these things that aren't
default. You're being emotional.
Exactly.
Emotional. Yeah.
And so that whole framework, I think, has fallen by the wayside, as it should. And I think increasingly, these legacy newsrooms, and it's always legacy newsrooms, I get so much less heat about what I tweet from Vulture than I did, from NPR. Mm-hmm. But these legacy newsrooms, in order to keep up, are going to have to just get over it. Get over it.
It's interesting. They always try to use the words emotional and advocacy. You can be an advocate by what you choose to cover. The New York Times overweening.
Exactly.
Tech trans coverage for a small group of people.
Yeah.
And this is, it's even the smaller than the trans people. It's like detransitioners or, what's her name? Harry Potter lady.
J.K. Rowling.
You know, they write a lot about it. I'm like, you can be an advocate by writing a lot because you have such power. And so,
There's always this performance for an imaginary listener or an imaginary reader. But no matter what you do, the people who don't like NPR are not going to like NPR. There'll be people saying defund NPR regardless of what Steve Inskeep tweets, right?
Yep.
And so it's like at a certain point, who are you fighting this fight for and is it actually helping?
It's been a bit
but in
hard.
General, I think a lot of these newsrooms to stay relevant are going to have to let the journalists be pretty free because there are other places where folks can go and be freer.
It's all
there's
in
a
plain
wide
sight.
Open landscape right now.
It's also all in plain sight. And I agree. One of the things I don't like is when journalists at the same institution start attacking each other. That I'm like, that's a civility in a newsroom kind of thing. And you can take that offline. You can take your argument offline and they don't have to be performative in that. And that's sometimes I'm like, this is not the place for this. And it's actually, it's a problem for a civil newsroom. You can fight, but again, do it in
although
a way that's,
every few years, the New York Times newsroom needs to publicly fight about something.
Yeah,
that's
they
kinda
do.
How
they
it goes.
Do. I get
that's
it. What I'm they talking do. About personal attacks on other journalists. Yeah,
that's, they do that
they
too.
Can fight about
they
issues.
Do that too. And I will say, as a watcher and a journalist,
yeah, you like it. It's fine.
I love it.
You know they're thinking that. Anyway, speaking of opinions, we're going to have different ones, I think, here. Let's get to our first big story. This year's Oscars went off without an incident, but not without making history. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once nearly swept the night's top awards. It won for Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor and Actress, Original Screenplay, and Directing and Editing. That's kind of a sweep.
That's a lot.
Michelle Yeoh is the first Asian-American woman to win an acting honor. I cannot believe this in the Academy's 95-year history. I guess I can believe it. And only the second person of color to win Best Actress since Halle Berry's win in 2002. That was 20.
I got
to
clarify you. What? She's not the first Asian woman. She is the first Asian woman who identified publicly as Asian.
Oh, right.
There was a
winner
in the 30s who basically passed as white but was actually Asian.
That was Merle Oberon, okay, on the Academy Award for Best Actress in a Performance in The Dark Angel in 1935. She was South Asian but passed,
yes,
as white.
It is really great to see the Oscars take women as seriously as the men for once. I think, yeah, this was the year of Michelle Yeoh and of, mm-hmm, Cate Blanchett. And there, mm-hmm, used to be a time when the Oscars didn't like to even think about awards for folks who weren't a certain age, looked a certain, mm-hmm, way. And to see them in their 50s do these works that are like masterclasses and to be honored for it, I think it's great.
Let's like take a listen in her speech. And I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. I did a long interview with her when I was at the New York Times at Sway.
Yeah.
She turned out to be kind of wacky and funny. And
I love,
you know,
that.
I'd expect her to be so grave from the mother in Crazy Rich Asians or, you know, her amazing career in martial arts and stuff like that in those movies. Bond, she was a Bond, not a girl. She was a force in that one of the Bond movies. And so she's had a long, interesting career, but she's hysterical, but she's also inspirational. Let's listen to her.
For all the little boys and girls who look like me watching tonight, this is the beacon of hope and possibilities. This is proof that dreams dream big and dreams do come true. And ladies, don't let anybody tell you you are ever past your prime.
I like that. Well, because, yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah, I remember the Oscars of 15 years ago, the nominees for Best Actress had to be really hot and like under 35.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all you kind of did unless you were Meryl Streep, right?
Right,
and
that's right.
I think with the big powerhouse performances of the year, mm-hmm, from women, Cate Blanchett in Tar, mm-hmm, Michelle and everything, these are meatier and better roles than the men are getting. And I like that. I think, yeah, it's great.
Netflix also had a strong showing. It won Best International Feature with All Quiet on the Western Front and Best Animated Feature for Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. It also won Best Documentary Short with The Elephant Whisperer. Hmm. So how did you do in your Oscar pool?
I figured that everything would do really well, mm-hmm, in part because it's a movie that everyone can get behind. And, mm-hmm, A24's Oscar campaign for that film was pitch perfect.
Explain that. You said this last night.
Yeah. So, you know, we entered the era of the Oscar campaign,
yeah,
during the 90s. With Harvey Weinstein, and probably the year that it really took off was when Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan. And, mm-hmm, that was just because
he did a good job.
He did, yeah, a good job of campaigning. And, yeah, and ever since then, the template has been that, like this Weinstein school of, for months,
yeah,
the cast, the directors, they're out there trying to meet every Academy voter that they can to win them over. And the cast of everything did that the most. Also, they had a campaign that made the film more than the film. The slogan for the film during award seasons was, "Everything has led to this."
Oh,
and,
wow,
so it's saying a lot about Asian identity. It's saying a lot about, you know, Michelle Yeoh and her whole career. How do you not support that? And I think especially after the year of the slap and declining ratings, mm-hmm, everyone involved in the Oscars needed a feel-good story that everyone, right, could get behind and say, this is good.
It was,
and
also,
that was,
can
it.
Can I ask you, it was also a feel-good movie and an inspirational movie, even though it was odd with the bagel and everything else. It was also, it had the indiness of it, right? But it also had the, you felt better after watching that movie. You just,
you,
yeah,
did. I mean, well, this is a movie about, how do you love your family and how do you, mm-hmm, find meaning in life, mm-hmm, right? And the, mm-hmm, beauty of Everything Everywhere All at Once is that you walk into it thinking it's a film about the multiverse, but it's actually about the bond between a mother and her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And the multiverse just exists in service of this family story, which I, mm-hmm, love.
Yeah.
And, you know, I am used to Marvel movies that, mm-hmm, will oftentimes treat the world building and the multiverse of it all as more important than the actual plot. This movie did the inverse. The,
yeah,
the very conceit of the multiverse just existed to get to the family drama. And,
yeah,
I think that's why it worked so well.
And
they,
wacky,
don't take the multiverse seriously.
And
everything in the multiverse is dumb. butt plugs and dildos and bagels.
Yeah, there was dildos in it. There was hot dog hands. Yeah. It was so surprising and delightful at the same time. And also upsetting, too. Like, there was a lot of, moments.
It's existential.
Michelle Yeoh's face. And they also had some wonderful, the other actors. Everyone around them, who also was up for Best Supporting, Stephanie Hsu, was amazing. There were so many amazing people around them, including, and I'm going to mess up his name, but the older actor, 94 years old, who has been in a million things. The whole cast was wonderful.
It's funny. I will say, as much as I love that movie, my least favorite part of the movie was Jamie Lee Curtis, and I was hoping that Angela Bassett would win the Oscar.
I know. Well, I talked to you really about that. Hoping. That face she had, she wasn't hiding anything.
She wasn't hiding it.
I got
and she
this
shouldn't
dress,
hide it.
And he shouldn't. She was amazing.
Everyone knows she is the best part of any movie she's ever in, and I think I was actually betting on her winning that movie. I thought that Stephanie Hsu and Jamie Lee Curtis would both cancel out the votes for the other, because they're in the same film. But no, good for Jamie. Love her. But
Her face. Yeah. I love that she did that. I was like, good for her.
Honest.
When I asked Jamie Lee Curtis, what's your face when you lose? What's your face when you win? And she did the smiley thing. And I loved it. I was like, why are you doing that? Why don't you just say, fuck, I should have won? That kind of thing. And that's what she did. And I agree. Angela Bassett is a national treasure. She was astonishing in the sequel to Black Panther. She carried the movie. Women carried that movie, really, in a lot of ways. Big hit. I cannot believe this woman keeps turning in performance.
Well, I can believe it, because you think about the way the Oscar treats Black women. It's kind of this way, even when they're nominated. We saw this year, to see The Woman King not get more nominations, to see no nomination for Till. That's a serious problem. And I think as much as the Oscars did a good thing by getting everything up there as many times as it did to not honor all of the Black women who deserved to be honored in this last year of film.
Agreed. I was sort of like, oh no. But I think the onslaught of the adorable Jamie Lee Curtis after being in sort of genre movies, as she called them, and she was, True Lies, she's been in Freaky Friday, she's been Halloween.
Yeah. Love Jamie.
I think he was just charming the pants off of everybody and delightful.
Well, that's the thing they all did. No one out-campaigned that cast.
Charming.
They're all grateful to be there.
Charming. I don't think she could have. I thought Jamie Lee was going to, because people are like, that lady's worked like a workmanlike actress.
I've seen those Activia commercials. I know she's working.
Poops. I know. She's just, people like that story. I'm not so sure in that case, but Angela Bassett deserves every single award that she
Did you like Jimmy Kimmel hosting?
I thought he was fine. I like him. I thought he was fine. Did you not?
I'm never itching to hear what he thinks, but he's always fine. I'm never like, what does Jimmy have to say about it? He was fine.
He made the Ozempic joke. He made the same joke. He had a couple of good jokes. I like the Nicole Kidman is still stuck in an AMC theater. I thought that was funny.
That was funny.
So everything, will that affect future nominees? This is the second low-budget film to win in a row to win Best Picture. Coda last year, it beat out huge blockbusters like Who Was Robbed, Top Gun, Maverick. I'm sorry, I love that movie.
We got into a fight about this.
I
you
only did.
Like that
Avatar
movie.
Too. But like, listen, this is $15 million. I think Top Gun spent $50 million on Tom Cruise's hair. Let's take a side note to Top Gun. Why do not you love Top Gun? It was such
a classic.
It's
horrible acting.
Oh, well.
The original film is a classic. This new one is that little love plot line between Jennifer Connelly.
Who looks fantastic. Let's just take a moment.
Was the most unbelievable plot. They're not in love.
Oh, come on.
I'm sorry.
Like,
the acting was stiff.
They ride around in the Porsche. But go ahead.
Yeah, they sure do. I just felt like it was really stiff and wooden. Yeah. And the special effects were great. And the planes deserved an Oscar. Just the planes. But it was a stiff movie. And
I think it was a classic. They did the 80s movie. I watched it with my wife under duress because she's one of those. She's like you, right? But she actually was like, okay, that was well done. It was 80s. It was an 80s movie with better special effects. And I liked it. I thought they did a really solid. Of course, it brought back people back to the movie theater. Thank you.
Oh, it sure did. It made a lot of money.
Top Gun. And not just that. It brought people excitement to come back to the movie theater. And I thought it was just, it's okay to have a movie like that. Like, it was well done. Well done,
Tom Cruise. And I have been enjoying all the movies that are getting me back in theaters. My thing right now is horror. Like, horror will get me back in a theater seat. I'm going to go see Scream probably tomorrow. I liked Cocaine Bear. It was funny horror. I liked Megan. All that stuff. Yeah. Give it to me.
I had, on stage with Jamie Lee Curtis was Donna Langley, who runs Universal, and she said Cocaine Bear was, she was in a pandemic not a drug haze, but she said, I'm in a haze. It was a pandemic haze, and I just approved it, Cocaine Bear. And they made a lot of money from that. And obviously,
they sure did.
Jamie Lee Curtis and Donna were involved with the Halloween thing, which they all made so much money out of it. Well done. Another well done revival of a movie. But again, Top Gun, I would say, I would have been loving if they won. I would have been screaming from the rooftop.
I think Oscar snobs would have spontaneously combusted see that kind of movie win Best Picture.
So good. I can't believe you didn't like the acting. That's meant to be bad. Ed Harris, who's always growling. I love his whole new growling thing.
My favorite acting of the last year was Cate Blanchett in Tar. And you don't like Tar.
I love Tar.
Cate Blanchett is doing the work in that movie.
Okay. Whatever.
It's a masterclass.
Oh, come on.
Tell folks why you didn't like it.
Because it's a lesbian movie where lesbians don't have sex. I'm sorry. Like, we don't get Cate Blanchett as a lesbian. Well, she's been in Carol. She actually plays a lesbian.
She's done lesbian stuff before.
She's done it, and she made out with, it was great. Like, literally. So, let me ask you, like, who do you think is hot? Give me someone hot.
Who do I think is hot right now? Oh, Chris Pine.
Chris Pine.
That's a man.
Chris Pine's in a gay movie and they never have sex. Come on, there's never
He's
any.
He's still
gays.
Pretty.
I don't care. It's like, no. Stop wandering around in your.
Also, did you want to see that villain have sex? She's a villain in the movie.
Yes, it's Cate Blanchett. Stop. Second of all, I didn't even know what was going on. Of course, my wife was like, it was very complex. I was like, oh my God, what the fuck is happening? Get me back to Top Gun.
I've watched it like three times. Yeah. I can watch that opening scene where she's at the fake New Yorker Ideas Festival or whatever, like forever. I just love it.
Okay, all right, whatever. I just don't know what happened. At the end, I was like, what happened there? Like,
that's the point. You're not supposed to know.
I want to know. I was like, I don't like Tar. I did not like Tar. Okay. I truly did not like Tar. I just don't get it. I feel stupid. I'm like,
You're not stupid, Karen.
I literally watched Plane with Jared Butler right after. I was like, I need to watch Plane. I love Plane. I love Jared Butler.
Okay.
I get it. And then
I know your type of movie.
And then Top Gun, which is like, oh, they have to blow up the thing and go over the thing and then the thing and then they all have to hug and then there has to be, speaking of gay scenes, they have to do the gay beach scene of everyone with their shirts off.
But still, not actually fucking.
That movie was more gay than Tar. Let me just say they had the whole gay scene. Anyway, come on, that was a good scene. I always loved the gay scene in Top Gun. They've had it several times.
So I see a question in here, you know, asking if seeing everything win Best Picture is going to make studios move to smaller movies.
Yeah, change. Yeah,
they will always keep making blockbusters on existing IP. Avatar 2. And Avatar 3, they're going to do it. Yeah, you know, Top Gun Maverick or a sequel to that, they'll always do it.
Yeah.
I think there might be more
He's
money.
He's coming with Mission Impossible. You can go with me. You and I can go together.
The Oscars always love smaller films as opposed to bigger films anyway. Yeah. That's just in their DNA. We actually have an episode in my podcast feed from last Tuesday where we talk about how historically the Oscars never really award blockbusters. Like Titanic was an outlier, you know? So I don't think this drastically changes the industry. If anything, I think it is a shock to the heart for Marvel. The first multiverse movie to win an Oscar for Best Picture wasn't a Marvel movie. It was Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah.
And I think people are going to expect Marvel movies to be as smart and as interesting and groundbreaking and beautiful as Everything
Some
Everywhere All at Once is. Some of them are. Most of them aren't.
No, so they're just working.
I don't think the entire industry is going to change because everything won, but I think Marvel is taking notes.
Taking notes. Absolutely. You got a story. Story's important.
Yeah, Parasite. Story matters.
Interesting. Speaking of, I want to get to international. Parasite director Bong Joon-ho called the Oscars a local festival. It is changing. Germany's All Quiet on the Western Front won awards in four categories. Best song went to Natu Natu, which is infectious, from Tollywood film RRR. They were there dancing their little hearts out. The movies about American icons like Elvis, The Fablemans, came short, though Top Gun and Avatar, of course, won Best Sound and Visual Effects, respectively. So is there more? There still isn't the international breakthrough necessarily. They're on the sidelines kind of stuff. Is that?
Yeah.
Is it a local festival?
I don't think the Oscars care. It is. Yeah. It's increasingly local because fewer people watch it every year.
Yeah.
At its peak, the Oscars had 55 million people watch the year that Titanic won Best Picture. Last year, I think 16 million people watched. But no matter how international you make your show, this is just the nature of TV. Mm-hmm. It's really hard in the era of streaming and on-demand viewing to get people to sit down to watch a 3.5-hour show.
Yeah. Yeah,
they're just not going to do it.
They're not going to do it unless there's something controversial or whatever. It's sort of a formulaic. It's so formulaic.
It's an old formula, you know? And I think that we're going to see the way award shows are done change drastically very soon. The mm-hmm. SAGs this year, I want to say, did it on YouTube. And yeah. it worked out quite well. I yeah. think we're going to
say... They get a lot of money. All those Golden Globes, they get a lot of money from these networks, right?
I think award shows, as we know it, won't exist 10 years from now. There'll be something different and hopefully better. And hopefully not 4 fucking hours long. Oh, my God.
I know.
God.
That is long. Although the dresses, my daughter watched it for the first... You know, she didn't couldn't pay attention last year.
Did you notice the red carpet this year? The dresses are great, but the red carpet this year was like champagne colored.
Yeah, I know. Jamie Lee Curtis had a good tweet. She goes, my carpet matches my drapes this year. It was really good. She made it good. Again, charming. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. These things, the Hollywood people love them, right? They love the parties.
Yeah.
They love things. But you could do all of it online. Honestly, that's where I watched every bit of it. I watched in pieces. I watched the best jokes. I may consume a bunch of it, but sitting there is just not a thing.
It's an enterprise of diminishing returns. Halfway through the Oscars last night, they just air the trailer for the new Little Mermaid movie. Because they could. You know, like, they're just reaching for straws at this point.
Yeah.
The business model is going to make less and less money every year they do this. They have to figure out a new way to give us award shows.
They do. But I don't know if you can. It's interesting. I think people still like the Golden Globes because you never know what's going to happen.
And, well, because they're all drunk.
But last year, the Oscars, of course, you never know what's going to happen with Will Smith, which they veered away from.
Although they did joke about it, which I appreciated.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it was good. But it was... you know, that was not something that was good for the brand, although it got attention, right?
It did.
Yeah. So anyway, he was not there. One thing, last question on this. Netflix still hasn't won Best Picture. Could that help or do they care or is it important to attract an audience? They made a big move and Apple TV saw a 20% increase in new users after Coda won last year. It's not clear if they stick around. Does it matter to them? They definitely are there. Ted Sarandos is there. I think Tim Cook went last year.
I think America's conversation about Netflix is so myopic.
Yeah, tell me why.
Netflix is the international streaming company. They have a footprint in every continent. They are everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they're poised to be even bigger abroad than they are here. They're truly global in a way that no other streamer is. Mm-hmm. So Netflix doesn't care. At first, they really wanted to make a point and prove themselves in Hollywood to the industry. Right. At this point, they're hell-bent on global domination, mm-hmm. and the Oscars matter so little in that larger framework.
Yeah, that is.
And what they do really well is they'll take a show that's a hit in one country mm-hmm. and then make like 12 other versions for 12 other countries where it could also be a hit. Mm-hmm. If you're doing that, you don't need a Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think putting that Chris Rock show, I didn't love the show, honestly. I thought it was kind of tired.
Yeah.
But that was a great idea. That's the sort of brainchild of Bela Bajaria.
And they're still the biggest. They have the most customers. I don't know. Everyone wants to act like Netflix is over. They're just less cool than they used to be. They're fine.
They're fine. They're just fine. Yeah. Speaking of streaming, Paramount is reportedly looking to sell its majority stake in BET, perhaps to Tyler Perry. It could use the cash to build out
might
a streaming
well.
Network.
Might as well. He's basically Mr. BET already.
Yeah, I know, right. It could use the cash to build out its streaming network. It did turn down a $3 billion offer, and before that, a $6 billion offer for the Showtime network, which includes shows like Billions and Yellow Jackets. I had an argument with Matt Bell, who writes a great column for Puck. I was like, they can't sell Showtime. It's where they have to get content. This is BET's a side or is a smaller thing. This mm-hmm. is the heart of attracting great content makers. So they're saying Paramount Plus with Showtime or something that was confusing from a branding perspective. But what do you think about this?
Yeah, it's confusing, but also it can be fine. You know, like right now, FX kind of only exists as a brand on Hulu, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and like that's enough. I think also Showtime has to exist as long as it's like on cable, right?
Right.
Like they have mm-hmm. to have some kind of infrastructure to be there. Mm-hmm. Larger picture, I want as a consumer all of these streamers to just go ahead and consolidate because it's getting too busy for me anyway.
Right.
So if any of these machinations mean that I have to click fewer buttons to watch what I want to watch on streaming, then good.
Yeah.
But this is
yeah.
the way it has to be, right? There's too many streamers. Some of this stuff has to go or get consolidated. So for me, that's the big picture long term.
Or become very niche-y, so you like it like BET. Like BET's got an audience, and if it can reach all its audience, that's great. But part of a bigger thing, it gets lost. It gets lost in those consolidations.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I don't think they are going to sell. It'll be really interesting what happens over Paramount if it sells itself.
Well, because Showtime has shows that like critics and TV fans love. They got Billions. They have
Yellow
what's
Jackets.
The one? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would hold on to Showtime. Yeah. It's a good brand.
Yeah, it's a good brand. And they also have, you know, obviously the Yellowstone juggernaut, which will eventually fall out of favor. But, you know, Dick Wolf is still churning out Law and Orders, and they continue to do it. It's a very lucrative business. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to these smaller studios, which Paramount is now, versus the big ones. It's going to be a struggle for them. It's not worth very much.
Well, what is streaming worth at all right now? Most of these streamers are losing money. Mm-hmm. Losing lots of money. Mm-hmm. So they all have to find a way to be profitable sometimes.
Not Netflix.
Yeah. But like, I think increasingly all of these streamers are going to have to feel a lot more like the TV that you and I grew up with.
Right.
With commercials and set showtimes. And you know what? That might be what needs to happen. You know, I think watching shows like The Last of Us become destination viewing on Sundays, people like that. You know, people like that. And I think people are actually okay with ads. I have Peacock and I have the ad version. I watch the ads. It's fine.
Do you think binging is over, though? I mean, look, Succession's another thing that's about to come back. I'm doing the podcast on it for them. That's every week. You have to wait for it.
I think that leads to more of a water cooler feel, which people want. When I binge a show by myself, I have nobody to talk about it with, really.
When I
watch The White Lotus over those 7 or 8 weeks, when I watch The Last of Us or Succession, I have dozens of fruitful and fun conversations with my friends and strangers online because there's time to do it. I think that's the way that we're meant to watch as a community. So I want more of that.
Well, good. And then maybe you could do a podcast on what the fuck was going on in Tar. Anyway, Sam, let's go on a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about another scandal involving priests and location data and take a listener mail question about podcasting.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from Atlassian.
The universal truth with our customers is they're all struggling to get stuff done. Our goal is how do we help them unleash the potential of their people, their teams, and their technology to actually get the right things done at the right time with the right people the right way. And when we do that, magical things truly happen.
Dom Price is Atlassian's work futurist. It's his job to help Atlassian customers imagine more effective ways to work.
It's completely natural to focus on what you can control in your team. The problem is if that's all you do, you get pretty myopic. The best teams I'm working with, they really work on who are the people upstream and downstream that we need to work with. How do we get flow across the organization? How do we get value into the hands of our customers quickly?
And sometimes achieving flow means that instead of asking who do I work for, it's asking who do I work with.
When you get team connection right, everyone benefits, the employee, the employer, and the customer, right? To get stuff done, the best organizations and teams right now are focusing on modern work. They're dreaming about the future, but they're dreaming about it by planting the seed to get the right things done right now.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom enable teams to work effectively together to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Learn more at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Sam, we're back with our second big story. Some Catholic priests are being watched from above, but not in the way they thought. Catholic nonprofit group spent millions of dollars buying up location data of priests who use gay dating apps that share the data with bishops across the country. We've seen something like this before. In 2021, a high-ranking priest resigned after a Catholic publication purchased data to show his visits to gay bars. Some of the same men behind that effort are said to be involved in this one. Creepy, although...
Question, though. So these gay apps will sell location data?
Mm-hmm.
To anybody who wants to buy
it? No, you can buy location data and then you track them to gay apps. Yeah.
But not from the app itself.
Some of them are. Like there's you can get people's location data.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
I mean, gosh, I just feel like at this point, I feel horrible for these men and what they went through. Mm-hmm. But also, as a gay man, speaking mm-hmm. to these other gay men, you really wanted to join the Catholic priesthood?
Mm-hmm.
You really like you? There are other churches where you can just be gay. Mm-hmm. This is the mm-hmm. one where it's like going to be an issue. Who are these people that are still trying to become gay Catholic bishops? I don't get mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting issue. My ex-wife used to run Planet Out, one of the two gay, you know, original portals. One was gay.com mm-hmm. and they end up merging, but I don't know if they probably still exist. And one of the things she always said in one of her decks is they 1% of their traffic came from the Vatican City. I know. Woo. And so she was always like, look at that. Like, of course, they were using the site. You know, I get that, but I do see why people are closeted on some level. They may be very religious and they have to. It's not just limited to gays. I have friends who are Catholic. They had a miserable marriage. They didn't want to get divorced. Yeah. Their religion held a very strong thing on it. And so in this case, it's creepy that they are being tracked by much more conservative members are trying to get rid of this. And so it's very hard to choose between something that means a great deal of your faith and this, which is who you are, right? And so I focus on the surveillance part of it. Like, they could do this to anybody. Where did you go? What did you do? And especially when it comes to gay people, tracking, oh no. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
No, like, I mean, this is a constant risk and danger. And it's sad. I'll see these headlines every few weeks or months. You'll see a new mm-hmm. story about location data and personal data being places it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
None of it shocks me anymore. Mm-hmm. I just assume everyone's buying and selling everyone's data. And it's sad that I'm so resigned to it. But I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, of course.
I tell everybody, right? Your phone is a tracker. You're being tracked.
You're being tracked.
You put it on yourself and you carry it around. And then you give up data about where you are, too. Mm-hmm. You're feeding the data monster in a way. But on Apple, there's even a setting that if you don't turn it off, it will tell you exactly where you've been. It stays on the phone. But if someone gets a hold of your phone, they can see it. And so I show it to people. I'm like, okay, you spent 45 minutes here and then you were here. And they're like, how did you know I was there for 45? I was like, it says it on your phone. It's tracking you.
Mm-hmm. So my thing is just like, all right, that's happening. We, I guess, can't stop it at this point. I do wonder what a scandal like this says about the future of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church needs all the people it can get right mm-hmm. now. You know, mm-hmm. people are not going to church anymore. The Catholic faith is losing people all the time. Just from a business perspective, it would be smart for the Catholic Church to be as open and affirming and welcoming to any and everybody as possible because they need more people. Yeah. That's what I don't get. And it's
not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. I was raised in a Catholic school. Mm-hmm. I'm not Catholic, but I know that faith well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're not setting themselves up for like long-term success, mm-hmm. I will say. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well,
my heart breaks for these priests, but it's like...
I don't think they care. And, you know, I think it does get to the issue of meaningful privacy legislation. Do you know, I bang on about a lot.
Well, is that ever going to happen, though?
Well, that's the issue. It almost did in this session. Of course, it was that and antitrust legislation and algorithmic transparency legislation ended up on the floor. Congress's health insurance data was stolen last week, for example.
Really?
Yes. They claim to have the data. It's not been verified, including social security numbers on Blackmart 4. And there's so much information everywhere. And the companies are being sloppy about it. And then they themselves are using it for all kinds mm-hmm. of things, selling it and things like that. They say it's anonymized, but much of it isn't. This is who else benefits from our lax privacy environment. The FBI admitted this month that it previously bought Americans' location data instead of getting a warrant. Why wouldn't they?
Oh, like, God. Wow.
Politico reports that Amazon's Ring gave police footage from inside a man's home as they investigated his neighbor.
Whoa.
You know, spokesperson Ring called the story a hoax, but Amazon walked that comment back. Ring, people can hack those things, all of them, just Ring. I don't have any. My son went around and unplugged. We had a house we moved into, had some, and my son literally walked around and unplugged all of them.
I believe it. They're so scary now. Mm-hmm. I'll be walking the dog around the neighborhood, mm-hmm. and the little cameras in the front yard will say, "We see you," or "You're on camera." It's so creepy.
Yeah, it is. These data brokers, they sell the location of people who visited Planned Parenthood. It starts to get very frightening. And then, of course, what you watch, something you do, what you watch, what you're not just for selling you stuff, but who are you? And they can mm-hmm. parse you into the smallest little bits. When you think, and it's good for, say, you know, the area you cover, culture in Hollywood, because they can know what to give you, right? You do that on Amazon by what you watch. You put footprints everywhere. And it starts
I'm not sure it's good, though. You know, I mean, we're in this.
But you like speaking some of my, it.
No, but okay. But let's think about. Okay, I cover a lot of TV and movies, mm-hmm. and the folks that make TV and movies have gotten better than they've ever been at tracking what I watch, how I watch it, when I watch it. Mm-hmm. It hasn't made the content better for me.
Right.
I don't think the TV I'm watching now is drastically better than the TV I was watching 15 years ago.
Well, it does give you knowledge. Like, you know, I'm curious that, you know, the Ashton Kutcher, Reese Witherspoon movie, like Your Place or Mine?
I don't want to know about it. Was it good?
Oh, you know what? It's Kara Swisher. I wouldn't have seen it, but I was like, yeah, it was ridiculously stupid. And it was so old school. And I loved it. I love old school. It was like a romance drama. And, you know, I definitely, and then I was served up on Netflix also, You People.
I did not like that movie.
Tell me why.
Kenya Barris hasn't made a good thing since Black-ish. Mm-hmm. And I think he's stuck in this kind of feedback loop with himself where he keeps rehashing his own life on screen instead of just dealing with his stuff with the therapist. I don't know. It's just the jokes were tired, if not just downright offensive.
Yeah.
It was a strangely sexless movie to be a rom-com. Like the romance between the two leads made no sense. They didn't seem to like each other, you know? So it just felt off. It just felt off and not made for this era or this moment.
It was such a good cast, right?
That's the thing. How do you screw up David Duchovny and Eddie Murphy and Julia Louis-Dreyfus? How do you screw that up?
Yeah, and I love Lauren London. I love her.
Yeah, she's great.
And all
the movie didn't hold together for me. It didn't hold together for me.
You know what was interesting is that it felt like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I was like, look what I'm watching.
But that was a better movie, right?
That was a great movie. Yeah,
I will say, you know, I think it's like, all right.
We have to rewatch that. It might not have been a better movie. Right? I haven't seen it. Like, you could be like, oh, ow.
Yeah. This question of, like, is the data and surveillance on what we watch making stuff better for us to watch?
Yeah.
It's not. But I think the larger issue with our viewing experiences, period, there's just too much shit to watch right now.
Yeah.
And it makes the experience of watching anything harder than it should be and less fun. Last year, there were over 550 scripted shows.
Well, that's going to be scripted. Less with the writer's strike and the contraction.
Yeah. But, like, that's too much. And so part of what makes a TV or film experience good is how you get to it and how comfortable it feels to watch it and whether or not you feel overwhelmed by the amount of stuff you have to watch. But sometimes the very number of things I need to watch makes me less excited about everything I end up watching. It's just too much.
So how do you find what you like? I'm curious if this, you know, without being tracked and being told what you like and they serve up more of what you like, which is very common now with all of them, by the way. You know, my daughter watches Frozen on repeat on, as I've talked about many times on Disney Plus, and we're getting, there's like 90 Frozen, like 2 minute ones, 10 minute ones, 12 minute ones. And so, and I appreciate it. I'm like, oh, another fun, Olaf is doing something for 13 minutes. Perfect. While I clean the dishes and you can watch this. Well, how do you find what you want to watch now? What is your method without being it forced, you know, down your gullet?
Well, I work at Vulture, so I trust the fine folks there. Some good folks that cover TV and movies there. And what they say to watch, I watch. I rely a lot on newsletters and, like, online voices I trust. Like if most of my favorite follows on Twitter are watching the same show and tweeting about it, I'm probably going to try to watch it. So I kind of trust my colleagues and peers.
Okay, so people, not AI, not
machine learning. Yeah, I trust people. I trust people.
Yeah.
What about you, Kara?
I think we're being manipulated in ways we don't even understand of what we should look at and what needs to be seen. And I think it's only going to be increasingly more. This AI will be telling us, now go watch this, go do this. He'll tell us to do a lot of things. This is time to brush your teeth. This is time to do that.
I just want less things to watch.
What's your favorite thing right now?
I really have recently become obsessed with The Real Housewives of Potomac. I hadn't watched
Washington.
Housewives since NeNe in Atlanta. But a critical mass of my friends were like, you must watch Potomac. I started, and Andy Cohen is an evil genius.
He is.
It's just like, it's trash TV. And the stakes are so low.
Wow.
But I love it. There was a 3-episode plot arc about how one of the housewives was mad because the other housewife had Googled her. And they got like 3 episodes out of that.
Oh, man.
They just make something out of nothing in this hilarious way. That's my current obsession. It's not good TV, but I like it. What about you?
Well, I have seen some of the episodes of Succession because I'm doing this podcast. I cannot reveal a thing, but it's terrific.
Okay. I'm ready for it.
Yeah, it's quite good. The writers, they're pulling out all the stops. It's so beautifully written, and now they're really writing the hell out of it.
Okay.
So I can't say a word about it, but the podcast is coming soon. But I watch old things. I'm now watching all of Madam Secretary. I love Taye Leone. I love Tim Daly. Turns out Tim Daly's a Pivot fan. I didn't know that, but I found out. I love that show, and I thought it's beautifully done. It's I like it better than West Wing, which I also recently watched the entire, all the seasons. So I go back and watch old seasons of things that I really like that are smart. So, and I love her. She looks fantastic, and she's plucky. She's plucky. Between her and Jared Butler, I'm very happy with my watching needs. Anyway, let's pivot to a listener question.
You've got. I can't believe I'm going to be a mailman. You've
got mail.
This question comes from Twitter user BG Ouija. Thank you, BG Ouija.
BG Ouija.
This is for you, Sam. For Sam, who I first heard as a political reporter on NPR, what do you think is the future of independent journalism? A small question. Is it Substacks, podcasts, blogs? Will those survive? I don't think they call them blogs anymore, but will those survive and thrive or be replaced by the next new thing? And I'm going to add, what is the next new thing, Sam?
Yeah, we don't know, but I will say, like, I think independent journalism always finds a way to survive. I think journalism is inherently a precarious endeavor, and it usually doesn't make money. Like, usually journalism as an enterprise does not make money on its own.
Yeah, it's not a good business. Yeah.
And when you think of, like, the heyday of newspapers, the news division wasn't making the money. The classified ads were making the money, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always going to be a problem and an existential crisis over whether there's enough money to make the journalism, because that's just the way this business model is set up. It's not a money-making venture. So that question, I never want to get too worried about it, because that's just always the question. In terms of, like, what's next, is it Substacks or podcasts or blogs? And it's kind of just like, we just find new ways to do the same thing.
Yeah.
You will either read a story or you will listen to a story. Before podcasts, you listen to stories on the radio. Now you do it on podcast, right? Before you read a Substack or a blog, you read a physical newspaper. None of these new things are like reinventing the wheel. You're either going to read it or listen to it or watch it. It's a question of where you do that and what buttons you click to get there. But there'll always be folks writing good shit and making good shit to listen to. I don't know. I'm less interested in whether I read the good writing on a blog or on a Substack or on a New York Times website. I'm more concerned about who are the people making this stuff, and are they paid enough wherever they are? And is it a diverse group of people making the stuff, right? I think that I want whatever the new space is, the new blog, the new Substack, the new whatever, pay people well, let them own their shit, and make sure that it's not just white guys doing it. And besides that, I don't care where it is. You know?
It's interesting, because you also have to be, as a reporter, I think, entrepreneurial in terms of picking different things. And I've done that. And you're doing, you know, you're writing, you're doing podcasts. You've done a lot of different things, and you've shifted a lot. You're very much like me, shifted as times change and as interest changes. It doesn't matter what the medium is, but you do have to, as a journalist, be very adaptable.
Yeah. Well, and you have to be... This is a thing that I had to unlearn. You know, when I started out working in public radio many years ago, they would tell you, like, you're not part of the story. You don't matter. Get out of the way. But in this media landscape, you need to be, and I hate to use the word, you have to kind of be your own brand and a thing that people will follow wherever you go, right? I want to make 100%. Journalism so that wherever I make it, people will come to hear it or see it or read it because I'm doing it there, right? And I think that, like, the days of just, like, trusting the institution to always take care of the journalist, those days are over. The industry's changing too quickly.
I literally had that conversation last night with a couple of people.
Yeah, and, like, God bless these institutions, you know? NPR trained me well, but I have to be in charge of my career at no company, you know?
100%. That's a very good piece of advice. Thank you, BG Ouija. All right, if you've got a question for your own, you'd like it answered, send it our way. Go to nymag.com/pivot to submit a question for the show, or call 855-51-PIVOT. Sam, one more quick break. We'll be back for wins and fails.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
Okay, Sam, let's hear a win and a fail besides Tom Cruise being cheated from his much-deserved Oscar, but go ahead.
I think Rihanna fans won. She performed at the Oscars Sunday night. She performed that song Lift Me Up from the Black Panther Wakanda Forever soundtrack. I hate that song.
Oh.
And I didn't want to hear it live. It sounds like a funeral dirge, which it kind of is. Yeah. But I was worried that she was going to butcher the live performance. It wasn't bad. And she's also said this week that there might be a new Rihanna album by the end of the year.
Oh.
So I think if you're a Rihanna fan, you're feeling okay right now.
So she checked, she tapped out, now she's tapping back in heavy, right?
We need a new album. It's been 6 or 7 years since her last album, and we miss her.
Don't you think she should have that baby first? I feel like, I don't know, maybe not.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever.
Listen, I make a dance hall album about the baby, about the pregnancy.
Great,
whatever you got to do, Rihanna.
Right. You know what, I've never done more work since I had children, but go ahead and say that.
So I think this will be a good year for Rihanna fans. And I think that in spite of me hating that song, she didn't butcher it at the Oscars. So I'm happy. So she's my win right now.
Oh, well, did you like the Lady Gaga one, Adjacent? The jeans and the simple?
She's a powerhouse. I didn't love that song, but whatever she sings, I'll listen to. She can sing. She can sing.
All right. Fail. What's your fail?
These Silicon Valley folks getting on my nerves with this bank stuff. Mm-hmm. Let Uncle Joe and Aunt Yellen figure it out. Mm-hmm. Shut up. I mean, we've talked about it already, but I do think that there's a class of man on Twitter further inspired by Elon Musk to just tweet bullshit and act like it's fact or like it's Bible. So for me, the fail is all the men of Twitter. Shut up. Shut up.
Shut up. I love it. I would agree.
And Elon, too. Stop tweeting, Elon. Stop doing it.
I'd be like frequently wrong, but never in doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And then they play victim.
Yeah. And then they had the nerve to say that women are too emotional. Have you seen these Twitter bros?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I call them pants pissers, and they don't like that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know, one or two of them had an issue with that back in the day. So I knew it would hit land. Those are very good. I like those. I like those. Those were great. I agree. A win is the government who handling this really well.
Yeah.
As we thought they would, because this is a serious issue. They could not handle this badly.
This is the thing I keep saying about Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. It's like, actually, he's doing fine.
Yeah,
he's not exciting at all, but he's doing fine. Biden. Oh, yeah.
Joe Biden. And I think a fail is probably these budget negotiations can stop taking us on the brink.
Well, we're going to have a shutdown, right? We're going to have a shutdown.
I don't know. I just stopped taking us to the brink. This is ridiculous. We didn't elect you to do this. We didn't. Do you think
some
we did?
People did. Some people did. The people who elected,
elected
Marjorie Taylor Greene elected her to do this.
Well, that's one tiny little part of Georgia. Like, they shouldn't determine these things, hold the rest of us hostage. Most people just want these things to work, just like with this banking thing. Everyone just wanted it to calm the fuck
just
down.
Let it work, yeah.
So anyway, that's what it is. Sam, that is the show. You can and should listen to Sam on his podcast, Intuit from Vulture and Stitcher's Vibe Check. Sam, what else is coming up on your shows? What's coming up?
Yeah, so we just took Intuit from once a week to twice a week. Now we're publishing on Tuesdays and Fridays. If you check our feed right now, the last week was all devoted to the Oscars. We talk about Oscars' historic problems with blockbusters, and then we have predictions from two Vulture film critics.
How'd they
do? They were pretty spot on. Everyone was like, it's going to be the year of everything. And they were right. This week, we're going deep on internet celebrity feuds. It'll be in feeds Tuesday of this week.
What's the big one?
The Justin Bieber, Hailey Bieber, Selena Gomez eyebrow feud.
Yeah.
It contains a multitude.
I'm going to just listen to it. I don't know about this.
And then we'll also break down what's being called the biggest scandal in reality TV history. This is the Scandoval from the Vanderpump Rules. Mm. I usually don't follow these things, but there's something to be said about internet culture and TikTok and studying them. So that's what we do.
Wow. Is there a scandal? They're lying all the time.
They are.
People are shocked by this?
People are shocked. And that's hard to do for reality
TV fans. It's like thinking world wrestling is... Okay. Sure. Okay. All right. Whatever. Yeah. Okay. Oh, it's real. It's not real. Oh, my God.
Exactly.
Anyway, please listen to all those things. They're wonderful. Sam does a wonderful job, as you can see from here.
Thank you. So Intuit publishes Tuesdays and Fridays, featuring the best and brightest from Vulture. And my other show, Vibe Check, comes out every Wednesday. And we talk about all the things on that show as well.
Yeah. Vibe. All the vibe.
All the vibe. Yeah.
All the vibe. Well, get with the vibe. I have no vibe, just so you know.
You have a lot of vibe, Kara. I love your vibe.
I don't know. It's not. It's whatever. It's just a grumpy old lady. That's my vibe. Me and Jamie Lee Curtis, she's just more friendly. Okay, we'll be back on Friday with more Pivot. And Scott will be back wherever he is. I have no idea where he is. Sam, please read us out.
Today's show was produced by Lara Naiman, Evan Engel, and Taylor Griffin. Ernie Indradat engineered this episode. Thanks also to Drew Burrows and Mia Silverio. Also, subscribe to this show wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to Pivot from New York Magazine and Vox Media. Kara, thank you for having me on.
Of course, anytime.
Yeah, the show is back on Friday for another breakdown of all things tech and business. Till then, don't trust the Twitter dudes. Don't trust them.
Support for the show comes from Atlassian. What do you think of when you hear the word flow? How about a smooth river of collaboration culminating in a shared ocean of positive outcomes across your organization? Atlassian software like Loom, Confluence, and Jira can help you achieve maximum flow across your teams by enabling fast and easy communication and connection no matter what time zone they're in. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unlock flow across your teams at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.